Today is July 13th, 2013. Okay, we'll start with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Good morning, everybody. Okay, so today marks a big transition for us because now we're starting on what's called the Uparipanasa. That means the final 50 suttas of the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the third division of the Majjhima Nikaya, the third and last division. So we've gone through two big milestones already, completing the first 50, now we've completed the second 50, not taking every sutta, of course, but the most important ones, and now we come into the third 50. And this sutta is called David. I have to apologize, by the way, that you're not in the announcement, it didn't mention the sutta that we'll be studying today. Because a new person has taken over the job of sending out the notices, and I was away this past week, so I didn't have access to email, so I couldn't inform her. So she sent out the announcement on Thursday, but hadn't sent out the announcement early this morning or recorded the phone message until I went for breakfast, and I conveyed the message to her at breakfast. But I'll see that this is done regularly in the future. Okay, so now we are taking sutta number 101. This is called Devadaha Sutta. It's named simply after the place where it occurs. Okay, so this sutta takes place when the Buddha was living in his own native land, the Sakya country, at a town called Devadaha. And so now the Buddha is addressing the monks, and he's going to recollect some past encounter that he had. Okay, so he begins by saying that there are some recluses and Brahmins who hold this view, that whatever a person feels, whether pleasure, pain, or neither painful nor pleasant feeling, all that is caused by what was done in the past. It's, in other words, it's all caused by past karma. Whatever one experiences, if one experiences pleasant feeling in the present, that's caused by past karma. If one feels painful feeling in the present, that's caused by past karma. And if one is just feeling just the neutral and different feelings, that is also caused by past karma. And so the view that's being enunciated here is the view that, if we look, jump to the end of the paragraph, that this is the view expressed by what the Buddhist texts call the Nigantas. The word Niganta means the ones without any bonds, without any ties or knots. And the Nigantas are what we know historically as the Jains, the Jainas. And the Jains were a school of Indian thought and practice contemporary with the Buddha. In fact, probably the Jains go back even long before the time of the Buddha. So the Jains could have been a school of Indian spirituality that comes from a very, very early period. It might have been, the Jains might even have been the descendants of the kind of spirituality that was practiced before the Aryan invasion of India. The Jains themselves speak of having 24 great spiritual masters before the time of the Buddha, and they call their spiritual masters Tirthankaras, which means builders of forts. Not fort, not automobiles, not the Ford car, but this is a Ford. You know, I don't think we use this word very much in contemporary English, but because we have bridges now. But the Ford is a place where, in ancient India, where they would cross the river. You know, a river would be flowing over a long distance, and you have to have places to cross the river. And so where the two banks come fairly close together, and the flow of the river is not so deep, that would be a ford, a place for crossing the river. So in Pali, we speak of it as Tita, in Sanskrit as Tirtha. You even have this in singular, Tota, like Katukastota, is that correct? Ambalatota, is there such a place? So all of that is just Tota, is just the singular derivative of Tirtha or Tita. Okay, so the Jains ascribe their teaching. They say that they have 24 Tirthankaras, fort makers, fort builders, who are supposed to be like the great teachers of Jainism. And whether all of these are historical, that is a matter of doubt. It could be just a legendary number. But the historical great teacher of Jainism is a person who is often mentioned in the Buddhist texts, and his name is, he's referred to in the Buddhist texts as the Niganta Nataputta. Niganta is the general word for a Jain ascetic, and his name is given as Nataputta, or sometimes Nyataputta. There are different spellings here. But he is known historically as the, sometimes he's referred to by his own devotees, the followers of Jainism. Is Mahavira, which means the great hero, and he's also referred to as the Jina, the victorious one, the conqueror. And so for this reason, the followers of the Jina come to be known as Jaina. Just like the followers of the Buddha come to be known as Bauda, or sometimes as Saugata, based on the word Sugata. And Mahavira, the Jina, was a contemporary of the Buddha, probably a little bit older than the Buddha. He died earlier than the Buddha did, because the Buddha's texts have recorded the Buddhist monks and the Buddha discussing the death of Mahavira. And he also taught in just about the same part of India where the Buddha taught, in basically in the northeast of India. And yet there's no record in the texts of a direct face-to-face meeting between the Buddha and Mahavira. It would have been like a really interesting meeting. But we see that the Buddha encounters the Jain ascetics and has discussions with them. And sometimes, I mean, it's possible that the Buddhist monks would have encountered the Mahavira and had discussions with him, but we don't see any record of a direct face-to-face discussion between the Buddha and Mahavira. And what's interesting is that there are so many similarities between Buddhism and Jainism, certain fundamental differences, but certain similarities. Okay, I'll give you a crash course in Jainism, or at least some of the basic fundamentals, because you could see, we'll see that this representation of the Jain position in this sutta is actually fairly accurate. Okay, the basic thesis of Jainism, or sort of maybe you can call this the starting point for Jainism, is the distinction between what they call jiva, which is the soul or life principle, and everything which is not alive, which is called ajiva, not living entities. And so the core of the person, or the core of all living beings, the center, the heart of all living beings, is the jiva, the soul, the innermost spiritual entity of the person. And through beginningless time, according to Jainism, the jiva, the living entity, has been mixed or mingled with non-living reality. We call matter in a very broad sense. The jiva in itself, in its own nature, is said to have four characteristics. That is, it has infinite knowledge, boundless knowledge, boundless perception, infinite perception, infinite bliss, and infinite power. But because the jiva has been bound up with matter, immersed in matter, so its infinite knowledge, perception, bliss, and power have been concealed or appear to be lost, the jiva becomes contaminated by its association with non-living substance. And according to Jainism, the jivas, the souls, transmigrate from life to life. And this process of transmigration has been going on, according to Jainism, through beginningless time. So you can see this is very similar to Buddhism, except that Buddha doesn't accept the idea of a jiva or a soul. But a process of beginningless transmigration has been taking place. And according to Jainism, the universe or the cosmos itself is without any beginning. So Jainism does not accept the idea of a creator God. There are many different realms of existence. There are realms of devas or deities, but none of them are a creator God. The devas too are living beings who have their own jivas which pass away from the deva world and take rebirth elsewhere and move on from life to life. Did you have a question, Mike?
Such a strong similarity here as to make this Gnostic.
To make this?
This is the perfect description of Gnostic faith. Your description of the faith of the jivas or the giants is essentially Gnostic.
And similar to Gnosticism.
Not just similar, but almost identical. And Gnosticism has been said to have originated in Persia and was opened up to the East and the West by Alexander the Great in 324, 325 BC. Mm-hmm. So this is fascinating to me. I'm wondering if you see anything there.
I have to admit I don't know that much about Gnosticism. But I believe that according to Gnosticism, the world does have a creation, but it was created by a demiurge who is like an evil deity. So the world is considered, well, essentially fallen or evil.
Well, that would be the contamination side, but the pure essence of being, that is to say the soul, for want of a better word, is non-created and eternal in the same sense that you described as having been infinitely eternal, as opposed to the creation. It's fascinating to me, and I'm just wondering if there's any historical connection here.
Of course, there could be flow of ideas back, from India through Persia to Greece, and then actually Gnosticism was floating around in the area of the Middle East, beyond Persia to Syria. What's now Syria, Lebanon, Palestine. So the ideas were there, and then they picked up elements from Christianity and they molded a Gnostic form of Christianity, which was condemned by the Orthodox Church, the Orthodox Christian Church. Okay, now an important point in Jain teaching is that the jivas are multiple and distinct individual. And this is where Jainism differs from Vedanta, or at least from Advaita Vedanta, the school of non-dualism derived from the Upanishads, which teach that there is a multiplicity of individual souls, but at the core of all of these souls, there is the one Paramatman, the one Supreme Self. And so we are all, this is according to Advaita Vedanta, we are all essentially identical with that one Supreme Self. And just our individual existence is an illusion due to Maya, the world illusion superimposed upon the one infinite universal reality. Jainism doesn't accept this idea of one universal self, but holds that there is a multiplicity of individual selves, which even in the state of liberation, retain their individuality. Okay, and so the jivas, or souls according to Jainism, are multiple and distinct. And what sort of determines their individuality, their individual destiny, the characteristics, the life experiences, is their karma. But karma, according to Jainism, is interpreted quite differently from in Buddhism. The Buddha teaches that karma is volition, volitional action. But Jainism teaches that karma is a kind of material substance that adheres to the soul and sort of covers it over, just the way you might have mud flowing into a clean lake, and then the mud will contaminate the clear water of the lake. And so you have the mud mixed together with the pure water, contaminating the pure water. And so karma is a kind of material substance which is created by our actions. But it's a material substance which adheres to the soul, covers it over, and determines the migrations or reincarnations of the soul. And the process by which the karma flows into the soul and covers it over and contaminates it is called, well, they use the Sanskrit word, the word is ashrava, which comes from a root shru, which means to flow, and the prefix ah. Does the word look familiar? Anybody see any? Does it have any resonances? Exactly. It's in Pali, it's asava. And so you could see that the Buddha took quite a bit of his vocabulary or terminology from words, terms, ideas that were floating around in the Indian spiritual scene of his time. But he took these terms and often gave them a different meaning. So in Buddhism, asava refers to certain very fundamental defilements. Say the defilements that are seen as flowing into the mind and sort of corrupting the mind and keeping it in bondage to the cycle of birth and death. But in Jainism, ashrava refers to the flowing in of corrupting karmic material into the jiva. And then what creates this karma is our passions or defilements. And so according to Jainism, there is a process by which passions, I think they might use the word klesha. I would have to check on that. Okay, so the passions lead to the creation of karma. Karma as actions that create this material karma that flows into the soul and contaminates it. And then the karma is conceived of not only as a kind of material substance, but it's compared to seeds which have the potential to ripen and create, well, they create individual existence, the individual forms we take as we transmigrate from life to life. And then the karma also matures or ripens in the form of particular experiences, pleasant experiences and painful experiences, or neutral experiences. And then these pleasant experiences and painful experiences will trigger more passions, creating a kind of vicious cycle. And what are the primary passions of which the chains speak? Raga. Again, they use Sanskrit. Vaishya. And the moha. So raga is attachment or lust. Dvesha is the same as the Pali dosa, which means hatred or aversion. And moha is kind of dull indifference or delusion. And so this is what keeps us in bondage, these passions. And so the aim of Jainism is to break free from the cycle of birth and death, to liberate the jiva, so that the jiva, the soul, shines forth in its intrinsic purity and enters with the ending of the cycle of birth and death. The jiva enters the final goal of Jainism, which is called moksha. Or nirvana. So if somebody comes into the classroom just now, like you just arrived, and looks on the blackboard, they'll think, ah, Bhante is just giving a quick rundown of the fundamentals of Buddhism. Right. But I've been explaining the Jain position of Jainism. Okay, thank you. Okay, so the aim of Jainism is to break free from the cycle of rebirth by destroying karma and the defilements, and thereby winning moksha or nirvana, in which the bondage of the soul, the jiva, to matter is broken and the soul is emancipated into its own intrinsic nature and remains in a kind of unconditioned realm. Maybe this is the way they understand nirvana. It remains in an unconditioned realm, sort of shining in its own infinite knowledge, infinite perception, infinite bliss, and infinite power. Okay, so this much seems quite similar to Buddhism. Now the difference comes in the way the Jains approach the task of liberation. For the Jains, what keeps the, or at least even in the theoretical part, there's the major difference in that the Jains have the doctrine of the jiva, the individual self or soul, whereas the Buddha rejects that. But in the practical discipline, this is where we start to see quite significant differences, in that for the Jains, the task, since it's karma that keeps us, that weighs down the soul and contaminates the soul, and karma is a kind of material substance adhering to the soul. So for the Jains, main part of their spiritual discipline is to destroy the old karma, to eradicate the old karma. And this is done by ascetic practices. So the Jains, the way the Jains look at it, that as long as the karma adheres to the soul, this karma will eventually have to ripen. And that will keep the soul in bondage to birth and death, to samsara. And so in order to liberate the soul, what has to be done is to burn up the old karma, or to wear it away. And this wearing away, the Jains have a special term, which the Buddha sometimes used in his own teaching, you know, especially when he's speaking to followers of Jainism. And this word is nirjara. It must be related to the word jara, which means old age. Because when one grows old, what happens is that the body becomes worn out. But nirjara means the wearing away of the karma that's contaminating the soul. And the way that the karma is worn out is by these strong ascetic practices. So that the Jains are well known for such practices as reducing the intake of food, long fasts, inflicting pain on the body, doing these exercises like squatting for long periods of time, or standing for long periods of time. And in fact, they go, at least one of the sects of Jainism goes completely naked. The other sect of Jainism wear white robes. So I think because the Digambara, the sky-clad Jains, they go completely naked. So it might have been a bit difficult for to propagate Jainism outside India. Like a group of Jains in America invite some of their ascetics to come to America to set up a Jain temple. have to hire a special plane for them and set up curtains running through the airport to get them onto the plane. When they disembark, coming out into the Kennedy Airport, Everybody will be looking around, who are these guys? Okay, so they go, at least some of them go naked. And the sort of supreme practice for the Jains is to completely abstain from food until one dies. That's regarded as sort of the cream of the practices for the Jains. But naturally only few undertake that kind of practice. And so the purpose of the ascetic practice is to wear away, sort of, it's a way of hastening the maturation of the karma. Instead of waiting for it to mature from life to life over the long extent of samsara, one burns it up quickly by the ascetic practices. But the Jains also have the practice of meditation, which has the purpose of stilling the passions, because it's really what creates the karma is the attraction or lust for pleasure and the aversion or repulsion towards pain. And so the practice of Jain meditation has the purpose of developing equanimity towards pleasure and pain. Okay, another very important practice for the Jains, which also was incorporated into Buddhism, though it also could have an independent development in Buddhism, but the terminology is the same, and that is ahimsa, which means harmlessness. Because according to to the Jains, the kind of action that generates the heaviest and darkest karma is violence or harmfulness towards other living beings. And so the Jains place a great deal of emphasis on non-harming, not harming by bodily action, by speech, and by thought. And according to Jain, this is where there's a difference between Buddhism and Jainism. According to Buddhism, what creates karma is the intention or volition. Whereas according to the Jains, karma can be created even by non-intentional action. So if we're walking down a path, you know, being moderately careful, but unintentionally we step on an ant or some other bug, according to the Buddha, there's no karma of taking life created, because we had no intention of taking life. But according to the Jains, that would create some kind of negative karma. And so the Jains are extremely scrupulous about all of aspects of their behavior to avoid, the Jain ascetics are extremely scrupulous not to inflict any harm on living beings. So the Jain ascetics, or at least some of them, they wear a cloth over the mouth so that they don't accidentally breathe in little insects. And they carry a broom when they walk on the path so that they could brush the path in front of them to wipe away the ants and little insects. And the Jains, I believe, the Jain lay people, householders, at least in the mainstream, don't work at agriculture. Because in agriculture, you accidentally kill living beings, or unintentionally kill living beings, when you plow the soil or harvest the crops. So for this reason, the Jain community in India, which still exists today, are extremely capable business people. I think in Bombay, in some of the major Indian cities, in Gujarat especially, the Jains are a very, very prominent part of the business community. And the Jain theory of truth They call us anekarta. It's a theory of, how to put this, multiple aspects of truth. So it's a very, very open, flexible, comprehensive theory of truth, according to which one can make statements which seem to be contradictory, but are true from different points of view. And so Jainism has been able to accommodate a great variety of opinions, a great diversity of opinions. And it's become an extremely tolerant religion, at least in theory. I don't know in practice. And for this reason, some of the major book publishers in India today, book publishing companies, are run by Jain families. Because the Jains have a very, very tolerant attitude towards the multiplicity of religions in India. So if you know of Motilal Banarsidass, do you know of that? I mean, if you get any books, almost any books from India, well, they're not the only one, but they are the major publisher of books on religion and spirituality in India. So many, they have thousands, well, hundreds of books on Buddhism, Vedanta, other schools of Hinduism, comparative East-West philosophy, Tantra, Indian culture. The family that publishes behind Motilal Banarsidass is the Jain family. That's their last name, is Jain, because they're Jains. Then the other major Indian publisher is called Munshiram Manoharlal. It's also a Jain company, run by Jains. Okay, maybe that's a rundown on Jainism in 40 minutes or so. And I'm not an expert on Jainism. So if you have really technical questions, I'll have to admit that I can't answer. But if you have any questions or comments on anything that I've just covered, then please feel welcome to ask. Okay, then we'll go into the sutta. And one thing that one notices in the Buddhist texts, in the early suttas, you know, the Buddha, early Buddhism was flourishing in a section in India at a time when there were multiple schools of thought arising, flourishing, circulating their ideas, debating, discussing different ideas with each other, sometimes competing for the allegiance of the householders. But we see in numbers of suttas the Buddha encounter Brahmins. When he encounters Brahmins, the tone of the conversation is generally cordial and friendly. The Buddha doesn't accept some of the ideas of the Brahmins, some of the basic ideas. Particularly, he doesn't agree with the attempts of the Brahmins to impose a rigid class system on the people of India of that period. He doesn't agree with the idea that those in the upper class, social classes, have some kind of spiritual entitlement that the people in the lower classes don't have. And the Buddha holds that people from any social class are capable of developing good conduct, capable of developing the mind and maturing wholesome qualities, and that anybody from any social class is able to achieve the ultimate goal of enlightenment, nirvana, liberation. The Buddha rejects the sanctity of the Vedas, which was a key tenet of the Brahmins. And he says that any kind of scriptures no matter how old, should be examined for their truth. But the Buddha and the Buddhists generally remain cordial within their relationship with the Brahmins. But when you see the Buddhists coming into discussions with the Jains, as we'll see in this sutta, often the tone can become quite caustic, quite severe. And so we're going to see some of that here. And so this, you know, raises the thought that, you know, since there are so many similarities between the Jains and the Buddhists, and also they were both flourishing in the same part of India, and they both had monastic orders which depended upon support from the householder community. And so there was, in a way, something of a competition for the following, that could have influenced the way the texts came to be formulated. Okay, so here the Buddha, now we come back to the text where he left it. The Buddha speaks about some recluses and Brahmins who hold the view that whatever this person feels, whether pleasure or pain or neutral feeling, all that is caused by what was done in the past. So we know that this is, as he'll say just below, this is the view of the Nigantas, the Jains. And now we come to their distinctive tenet. So by annihilating with asceticism past actions or past karma, and by doing no fresh actions, creating no new karma, there will be no consequence in the future, no consequence in the form of another rebirth with pleasant and painful experiences in that next rebirth. So with no consequence in the future, there is the destruction of action, that of all of the karma that is defiling the soul is eliminated. With the destruction of action, there is the destruction of suffering. With the destruction of suffering, there is the destruction of feeling. With the destruction of feeling, all suffering will be exhausted. So that, in a nutshell, is the Jain scheme of liberation. Okay, so the Buddha, now he says that he approaches the Nigantas and he questions them whether it's true that this is their teaching. Okay, and so some of the Jains, I guess the more knowledgeable ones, will admit this. And so now the Buddha is going to question them further. So he says, do you know for a fact that you existed in the past, and that you did not exist? So they say no. Do you know that you did evil actions in the past and did not abstain from them? They say no. Do you know that you did these specific evil actions? They say no. Do you know that so much suffering has already been exhausted, eliminated, that so much suffering remains to be exhausted, but that when so much suffering has been exhausted, all suffering will have been exhausted? They say no. Do you know what the abandoning of unwholesome states is and what the cultivation of wholesome states is here and now? They say no. Okay, now the next paragraph, the Buddha simply just sort of reviews what they've admitted, that they do not know that they existed in the past, and so on, all the ways to that they do not know that eventually, all according to their way of practice, all suffering will be exhausted. Okay, then paragraph 6, the Buddha says, if you knew that you existed in the past and that it is not the case that you did not exist, and so on and so forth, and if you knew that when so much suffering has been exhausted, all suffering will have been exhausted. Or if you knew what the abandoning of unwholesome states is and what the cultivation of wholesome states is here and now, that being so, it would be fitting for the Venerable Niguntas to declare, whatever this person feels, all that has been caused by what was done in the past, and with the destruction of feeling, all suffering will be exhausted. Okay, I'm going to skip over the simile and just jump to paragraph 9, where here the Buddha was here. This is a direct continuation of the argument. Then the Buddha says, but now since you do not know that you existed in the past, and that it is not the case that you did not exist, and since you do not know any of the other things, and you do not know what the abandoning of unwholesome states is, and what the cultivation of wholesome states is here and now, it is not fitting for the Venerable Niguntas to declare, whatever this person feels, all that is caused by what was done in the past. By annihilating with asceticism past actions and by doing no new actions, there will be no consequence in the future. And so on, with the destruction of suffering, there is the destruction of feeling. With the destruction of feeling, all suffering will be exhausted. Okay, so now if we look at this, basically it's saying that the Jains are making certain claims. They're making claims based on certain hypotheses. They don't know, or based on certain premises, certain presuppositions. They don't know the truth of these propositions for themselves. So therefore, they're not justified in promulgating their basic map of path to liberation. Doesn't that seem to be a fair summary of what's being said here? I wish Yu Rong was here today, because she's good in playing so-called the devil's advocate or Mara's advocate. I don't like to be, as a monk, to be thrown in that role myself. But does anything seem problematic about this argument from our Buddha's point of view?
I'm not so sure that it's problematic, but with Buddhist faith, we place our faith in the Buddha, even when we don't know.
Yeah.
We can safely say, I don't know my past life.
I just got distracted a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know my past life, but I have faith in the words and the teachings of the Buddha, which is part and parcel of Buddhist practice.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I mean, I say, you know, I think I've taught thousands of times as a monk, well, it's through our beginningless greed, hatred, and delusion that we've created this karma, and so we have this store of immeasurable store of karma from the past. It's our defilements and karma in conjunction that bring us into the present life. And when we act under the motivated by the defilements, we're creating new karma, and this new karma is going to, as long as we have the defilements, the new karma is going to bring us forward into future lives, and so we're going to be experiencing this boundless suffering of samsara because of our defilements and karma that we've been activating and creating in the present. And the Buddha himself says, okay, I think it's in the Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 15, the sutta on the beginningless round of samsara, Anamataka Samyutta, that, O monks, the first point cannot be found of beings roaming and wandering through the cycle of birth and death. Anamatago yang bhikkhave samsaro. Without a conceivable beginning, O monks, is the cycle of birth and death. The first point cannot be found of beings roaming and wandering from life to life, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. And then what do you think, O monks? What is more? The tears that you have shed roaming and wandering from life to life, or the water as you've been weeping over the loss of mother, loss of father, loss of sons, loss of daughters, loss of brothers and sisters, this or the waters in the four great oceans? Then the monks answer as they should. As we understand the Dharma, this is more the water in the four great... As we understand the Dharma, this is more the tears that we have shed over the loss of mother, loss of father, brother, sister, son, and daughter. This is much, much greater than the waters in the four great oceans. Okay, if I think in the present life, okay, when my mother passed away, okay, I shed a few tears. I haven't lost any sons and daughters. I have one sister and she's still alive. One cousin who passed away before me. Aunts and uncles I hardly knew, for I didn't know well enough to shed tears over them. So not that many tears. And yet, I take it on faith as a Buddha, on trust, that the tears that I've shed in beginningless samsara are much greater than the waters in the four great oceans. So suppose some Jain ascetic comes up to me and says, "Well, Bhante, do you know that you've shed more tears over loss of mother, loss of father?" No. Do you know that you've been wandering from life to life through ignorance and craving? No. Do you know that the samsara is without conceivable beginning? No. So then the Jain ascetic could say to me, "Well then, but since, friend Bhante Bodhi, you do not know that you existed in the past and that you did not exist, you do not know that you've been wandering through beginningless time in this samsara, you do not know that you've been bound by ignorance and hindered by ignorance and bound by craving, you do not know that you've shed so many tears over your loss of mother, loss of father, loss of brother, loss of sister. Therefore, friend Bodhi, it is not fitting for you to declare that this samsara is without beginningless, without discernible beginning. No first point can be discerned of beings roaming and wandering from life to life, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. What am I going to say?"
My answer would have been not yet, not yet, and not yet. After practice, meditation, after fourth jhana, I'll see in the future.
Well, that's not the way I would usually. In fact, I've been sort of challenged like that by, you know, skeptics and non-Buddhists and people who come to listen to lectures on Buddhism out of curiosity. And then there's a generation of what they call secular Buddhists, people who don't accept the idea of rebirth and of beginningless samsara and karma coming from past lives. But they say that all of these are just metaphors that the Buddha used to make his teaching intelligible to the people of his time, or just cultural baggage that the Buddha took on in order, because he was, you know, grew up in Indian culture. Okay, so I'm challenged like that, then what do I say? I say, well, I have trust in the Buddha Gautama, who doesn't claim to be omniscient and all-seeing, at least according to the oldest texts, but who claims to have known this through his direct knowledge. And on this basis, he claims, he says, and maybe if I have the Samyutta Nikaya on hand, I'll open up to chapter 15 and say, see, this is what the Buddha says in chapter 15. Or if I have, well, we have the Majjhima Nikaya on hand, let's open up to Sutta number 4. Go to page 105. We say the Buddha here says, when my concentrated mind was thus purified and so on, I directed it to knowledge of the recollection of past lives. I recollected my many past lives, one birth, two births, 100,000 births, many aeons of world expansion and contraction. And then going further down to paragraph 29, with my concentrated mind, I directed it to the knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings. And so I saw beings passing away and taking rebirth. And I understood how I saw beings passing away and taking rebirth, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. And I understand how beings pass on according to their karma. Thus, those who did bad deeds of body, speech, and mind, they met with misfortune in their present lives, and those who do good deeds by body, speech, and mind re-arise in good realms and meet with good fortune. Okay, so I point to the text and say, that's my authority. The Buddha knew this for himself. I have trust, faith in the Buddha, and so on the basis of my faith, basis on trust that the texts have been handed down reliably, I have trust that the texts are speaking quite literally, that they're not intended metaphorically or poetically. And so I say, that's my basis. So why can't the Jains say, this is our basis? It seems to me, I have to say, unfair. Am I missing something? If I am, then somebody tell me. Don't think Bhante must be a Jain mole who's been somehow planted in Trungyan Monastery to lead the devout Buddhists of Zhuangyan Monastery to Jainism.
There is a difference, I think, between belief and knowledge.
Yeah, okay.
Because I'm also thinking of the Sutta to the Kalamas, where he's saying, don't believe this just because I say it, or if other people say it. Something that's coming to me about why he may have been so hard against the Jains were the people that he was practicing with when he was having just a few grains of rice before he came to the way. Were they Jains?
I thought
they were.
That's an interesting question.
And a very fundamental thing that really, I think, within a few weeks at the most led to his enlightenment was cutting off from the ascetic practices.
Yeah, the practices that the Buddha undertook during his period of striving were very much like the practices that the Jains undertake. And the Buddha, of course, he rejected that mode of practice. And he, within his scheme of the middle path, he put it over as one of the two extremes to be avoided by one who has gone forth from the world. It's the extreme of Attakila Matano Yoga, devotion to self-mortification. And the Jain practice is, at least it's described very much as a kind of self-mortification. Did somebody have...
Maybe what the practitioner begins with faith, but I think in Buddhism, faith can be verified through practice. So eventually.
Okay, we say faith can be verified through practice. I mean, I don't know much about the advanced stages of practice in Jainism, but I'm wondering if they, the Jain ascetics, would say that they can verify their principles through practice?
Unless they know how much karma they have created in the past, because their way of practicing is through austerity, to wear off the karma.
Actually, this brings up a good point, that if their aim is going to be the eradication of karma, that seems to be a good point, then they should know that their practices are actually eradicating karma.
That all through their practice they cannot verify their point.
That seems to be quite a good point, yeah, that they can verify that their practices are actually eradicating karma, and that they can't determine how much karma that they've eradicated. So in that way, yeah, I would say that the Buddha's argument does have some strength to it. The Buddha does have a good argument against the Jains on that point. That's very, very good.
That's not my point.
Excuse me?
It's not my point.
That's not your point.
No, I'm not that quiet. That's my friend Avendero's point.
Excuse me?
Remember that it's Avendero who makes point.
Excuse me?
Another
month's
home. Oh! I had to
make
that.
Okay, it's a good point. Okay, this is from the internet, this question?
Yeah.
Somebody says, I wonder if the Buddha's extreme ascetic practice prior to enlightenment has some source from the Jain teaching, or from his two meditation teachers. It actually seems to be the extreme ascetic practices seem to be quite different from the teachings that were given by the two meditation teachers. Of course, in his account account of the training under the two meditation teachers, there's no mention of austerities. All that's mentioned is the practice aimed at these formless meditative attainments, the base of nothingness and the base of neither perception nor non-perception. But the first part of this question is actually exactly the question that Barbara asked before, that it's possible, you know, the Buddha doesn't mention actually coming into contact with Jains prior to his enlightenment, but he did have an association with five other ascetics who looked to the Buddha as sort of their already, or the Bodhisattva, we call them at that point, as their leader, their exemplar. And it's said, you know, in the commentaries, excuse me, that the five ascetics came from, actually from the Sakyan state, that they were Sakyans, or at least one of them, Kundanya, was a Brahmin who had left the Sakyan state and then came down to follow the Bodhisattva in his ascetic practices. But the Buddha must have picked up these ascetic practices I can't say whether he picked them up actually from the Jains themselves, because the ascetic practices were probably shared by a number of other sects and schools from the period. But this was like one of the widespread means of practice amongst the spiritual communities. And the Jains would have been at least one group that exemplified, that retained these ascetic practices. So I don't know whether the Buddha himself actually, you know, directly learned them from the Jains or just picked them up from the dominant mode of practice of that period. But certainly the Buddha even prior to his enlightenment, he saw that the ascetic practices don't lead to enlightenment, and then he rejected them and struck out with the middle way, which avoids that extreme of ascetic practice. And because of, you know, the Buddha's middle way of practice, the Jain scriptures speak about the Buddhas as those so-called bhikkhus. You know, they think of the Buddhas as being sort of pseudo-renunciants, because they see the Buddhas don't undertake the long fasts, and they wear robes that cover the whole body, and they live in, you know, fairly comfortable dwelling places. Actually, the Jains have their monasteries, but their way of life is more austere. I had my own one encounter with Jains in India this was 1975, and I went to visit, you know, this holy sacred places of Buddhism in India. So I went to, the main place was Bodh Gaya, which is the site of the Buddha's enlightenment. But I took a little side trip to Rajagaha, which is not so far from Bodh Gaya. And then I went to the bamboo grove, which was one of the Buddha's favorite dwelling places, the site of, well, the bamboo grove is the monastery outside Rajagaha. And then one day I went into the town, and there was a Jain, this was right after the, fairly soon after the rains retreat, it must have been November, and that's a time when there's a major Jain festival. And so there was a large group of the Jain ascetics who come to Rajgir for this festival. And these were the naked ascetics. And I saw there were a couple of Thai monks from Thailand, who were sort of attached themselves to the group that was going for the festival. And so I thought I would stick around or attach myself to the group. So I sort of linked up with the Thai monks, and we went to observe the festival. And the Jain people were very, very friendly to us. But they didn't seem to regard us, you know, as being real ascetics. You know, they think, like, our monks are the real ascetics. But you guys with your robes and the Thai monks had cameras. You know, like, you're just amateurs sort of playing at being monks. Yeah, Michael?
I'd like to ask a question about the production of karma, the continuation of karma, and doing harm to self as opposed to doing harm to others. Because it seems to me, my instincts tell me that if I do great harm to myself, I'm actually creating karma.
Yeah.
So therefore, this level of asceticism would also be karma producing.
I think that would be so, definitely so, from a Buddha's point of view. But the way the Jains see it, this is the means of wearing out the old karma, of sort of burning up the old karma.
But from a Buddhist point of view...
Yeah, this is actually quite an important point. And what the Buddha teaches, you can see this in sutta number 51, if we go back to that sutta. The Buddha speaks about four modes of practice, which the first three of which he rejects. The first three of which he rejects. Let me get the right page. It actually starts on page 445 at the top. There are four kinds of persons to be found existing in the world. What are the four? A certain kind of person torments himself and pursues the practice of tormenting himself. Another kind of person torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others. Then a third kind of person torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing himself. And also torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others. And then there's the fourth kind of person who does not torment himself and does not torment others. And since he neither torments himself nor others, he is here and now hungerless, extinguished, and cooled, and he abides experiencing bliss. Brahma Bhutena Atana, with a self that's become divine. Okay, then when he comes to explain the kind of person who torments himself, then he lists or enumerates all of these types of ascetic practices. That's on page 446. That's the person who goes naked, who doesn't stop when asked, he doesn't accept food under certain conditions. He observes various kinds of ascetic practices regarding food. He clothes himself in hemp or in these rather rough types of clothing. He pulls out the hair and beard. I believe that's the Jain practice as well. Or at least it might be a practice recommended for the Jains. I don't know that all of them do that. I think they shave the way the Buddhists do. Who stands continuously rejecting seats, that's a Jain ascetic practice. One who squats continuously, maintaining the squatting position, that's also a kind of Jain practice. And one who uses a mattress of spikes, again, that might be a Jain practice. Yeah, so those are the practices of torturing oneself that the Buddha rejects as being harmful and fruitless. Okay, I think we'll stop now and we'll continue with the sutta next week. And we could have some discussion after lunch, say about 12:10, we'll gather here. Okay, so let us end with the sharing of the merits. So we share the merits with the devas, the bhutas, or fear spirits, the nagas, the dragon spirits, and with all beings, wishing them to rejoice in these merits and protect the sasana, protect the world, protect ourselves and others. Akasa ta jabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva shiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata jabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva shiram rakantu desanam. Akasata jabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mantaram Etavatacham Hehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Devanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Etavatacham Hehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Bhutanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Etavatacham Hehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Satanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Baba Gupadaya Vichihetato Etantare Satakayupapana Rupiya Rupicha Sanya Sanino Dukkha Pamuchantu Pusantu Nibhutin. Okay, let's stand. And we end with three half hours.